Hey everyone, I just wanted to pop in here before the show actually starts with a brief programming note. You're tuning in to hear me talk about a book that is telling the story of two pandemics. Possibly you have even read Doomsday Book recently because you saw it on a list of books that might help you cope with living through a pandemic of our own. But here's the thing. I recorded this episode long before COVID. I record ATOS episodes about 3 years in advance because I'm a weirdo. And so I don't talk about COVID at all. I don't think about this book through anything even close to that lens. And that might actually be refreshing for some of you, but I expect that it will leave most of you feeling like something is missing here. And I thought about revisiting this book. In fact, that would have been a lot of fun for me to do. But the actual reason that I record these episodes 3 years in advance is I've got a toddler. And so I just did not have time to read this book again, think about it like that again, and stay on top of the other schedules for the other shows here. But what I want to do instead, actually, is to recommend to you a podcast that has covered Doomsday Book, at least in part by thinking about our experiences of the COVID pandemic. It's called The Big Read Cast, and it does exactly what it says on the box. Bill and Joel read really big books and talk about them for a while. The gimmick there is that they only talk about books that are at least 500 pages long. The Big Read Cast is absolutely one of my favorite podcasts. I get excited every time I see a new episode show up on my G-Jaw, and their episode on Doomsday Book was just phenomenal. I mean, it was an awesome, awesome podcast. So I heartily recommend it, and I hope you'll check it out. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the show. My name is Glenn McDorman, and this is ATOS, your Black Death speculative fiction book club podcast by Clay Temple Media. This month, we are talking about Doomsday Book, a science fiction novel by Connie Willis. This was originally published in 1992, and it won all the awards. It won the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Locus, and probably more that I'm not even aware of. This book also won one of our Patreon votes. That's probably the best award you can get, I suppose. And I've been very excited seeing it getting closer on my recording list. I love Connie Willis. She is one of my favorite writers. I mean, she's won more awards than anybody, so I guess she's probably one of everyone's favorite writers. And I first encountered her when I was in the Army, which is true of so many of these writers we've been talking about here on this show. Her novel, To Say Nothing of the Dog, had just come out when I got to my first duty station, and it was prominently displayed at the library that I could walk to from an Army post that doesn't even exist anymore. And I was hooked on her work immediately. So I read Doomsday Book not long after that. In fact, I think I actually purchased it at The Tattered Cover, the sort of local independent bookstore in Denver, still one of the best bookstores on the planet. And it was a big part of my Christmas that year. And although it is totally coincidental, I'm glad that we're actually doing this book right at the start of the Christmas season. The book does take place at Christmas. It's an important part of the setting. And Connie Willis is a huge fan of Christmas. She has two collections of SF Christmas stories that are just absolutely just delightful. And in fact, this is something that Brandon and I have been working through. We've been reading through these stories as our December Patreon episodes. This year's actually going to be the fourth year that we've done that. We're reading The Pony from her collection, Miracle and Other Christmas Stories. That's still the first of the two collections, but we'll get to that second collection eventually. So if you're looking for more Connie Willis after this book, come over to Patreon, sign up, and you can check that out. And then also, you know, the three other stories that we've done as well. All right, well, let's get into it. Let's take a deep breath and get into Doomsday Book. The year is 2054. The place is Oxford. Our principal characters are all historians. There's Dunworthy at Balliol College, Gilchrist at Brasenose College, and then there is the postgrad student, Kivrin. What historian means in this context, though, includes a bit more than it does today, and that will be a topic for our next segment for sure. And the reason there's more to it is time travel. Willis doesn't give us a history of time travel or even really much of an explanation about the physics of it, but what we know is this. Some time ago, physicists figured out how to send material objects, and that includes people, to send material objects back in time and retrieve them, to bring them back to the present of 2054, or whenever it is that they actually made this discovery. And of course, now, right, we've all seen Back to the Future, so of course we are inclined to worry about paradoxes, but Willis has that covered. The timeline simply protects itself. You can't actually bring anything back that would be problematically anachronistic, right? You can't bring back a modern disease. So if you're carrying a version of the flu that didn't exist in the time to which you're going, the time traveling mechanism, the physics here simply won't work. You also can't appear in a time or a place in such a way that you'll interfere with events as they unfold. So you can't miraculously save Kennedy or kill Hitler, right? The two big things that everyone does with a time machine. And if you do try to do those things, then the mechanism will drop you somewhere or really, you know, somewhen else, I guess we should say. And this is called slippage here in this book. And slippage can range from a few hours to a few weeks, depending on how close to something really crucial you've gotten. And so in this speculative world, historians now have direct access to the past. They can travel to the past just like we can travel to another country and visit it for a while. So these historians can go to the past like it's another place. They can make observations about what it's like there, and then they can return to the present and report on them. Naturally, of course, there are all sorts of rules about this. The history faculty have devised a system for determining which centuries are safe to travel to and which are not, and solidly off limits are the entirety of the Middle Ages. So as far as we can tell in this book, it's really only modern historians who've been able to actually make use of this technology. So from 2054, historians can go back to the 20th century. That's something they seem to do a lot. And also some earlier centuries, but absolutely nothing before 1500. And in fact, it doesn't even seem that anyone has gone back for the first performance of Hamlet in the early 17th century, around 1600 or so. And that's kind of a shame. Okay. So that is time travel, and we are going to do some time traveling in this story, of course, but let's finish getting the setup first. So it's Christmas time, and naturally the university is winding down for the holiday break. The head of the history faculty, in fact, has already left for a holiday fishing trip to an undisclosed location. So that means that Professor Gilchrist is now the acting head, and Gilchrist is a pompous, selfish, a short-sighted jerk, and so he's definitely going to abuse his power. That's just clear right from the start. Gilchrist is also a medievalist. He works on the 14th century, which most scholars view as a time of crisis, what with the Black Death and the Great Famine and the Hundred Years' War, and of course, most importantly, the not having any coffee. And now that Gilchrist is temporarily in charge of the time travel restrictions, he's going to lift them from the Middle Ages so that he can send a postgrad student back to Oxford in 1320, right in the aftermath of the Great Famine, but before the Black Death of 1348. And this trip is really supposed to be a warm-up for what he actually wants to do, which is to prove that the Black Death wasn't nearly as bad as everyone thinks it was, that the consensus that the disease killed between one-third and one-half of the population of Europe is greatly exaggerated. Kivrin, that's the postgrad student who's going to be actually taking the trip. Kivrin is not Gilchrist's student, and her actual tutor is checked out of this whole process. So Professor Dunworthy is also involved in this process because he's had Kivrin as a student, and he has grave reservations about this plan. And Dunworthy simply doesn't want Kivrin to go. For one thing, he just doesn't think 1320 is safe, but he also simply doesn't like that Gilchrist is violating the spirit of the rules, even if he's not quite violating the actual letter of them. And of course, in order to do all of this during the very brief time that Gilchrist has this power, because the real head, the real guy in charge is on a fishing trip, he's rushing things, right? Gilchrist is rushing things here. He's skipping a number of safety protocols. He's using an inexperienced technician to manage the time travel mechanism. And so Dunworthy insists on a number of concessions, a number of compromises here. And this includes a loan of a more experienced technician from his own college. And he also insists on double checking that Kivrin has received inoculations against everything possible to get in the 14th century, including the plague, just in case the slippage is so intense that she actually ends up in 1348 or 1350 and is exposed to the Black Death. So that's the setup. And of course, Kivrin is excited to go on this trip. She's excited to be the first person to travel to the Middle Ages. And how could you not be? I mean, I would be volunteering for this, even knowing that Dunworthy has legitimate concerns about this. And even knowing, of course, that this is a story, so it's going to have to be about things going wrong, I'd probably still take this risk. So I'm right there with her on the excitement. And her excitement really is palpable. It really leaps off the page. And so Kivrin goes back in time. And of course, it does all go wrong, and for much of the book, things are going to go from bad to worse. And now at this point, the story bounces back and forth between the two times. We've got the present of Christmas 2054, and then we've got Kivrin's experiences in the past. And really, the plot of the book is a mystery plot. There are a number of strange things that are going on that are all related to Kivrin's time travel, and these are going to take a long time to resolve. Willis is a master at drawing these threads out and giving us just enough to want to keep turning the page, even as we are frustrated that we're not getting the answers that we want so badly. And the mystery starts like this. Dunworthy and some of his colleagues adjourn to the nearby pub while they're waiting for the technician to get a fix on Kivrin. That is to say, they're waiting for him to figure out how far off in both time and space Kivrin has ended up from where they had planned to drop her. And the technician, his name is Bodrey. So Bodrey rushes into the pub and simply says that something isn't right. And then he collapses and passes out. And Bodrey is very ill, and he simply cannot tell Dunworthy what he meant by this cryptic phrase, and so Dunworthy wants to abort the whole mission, or, you know, at the very least, he wants to recall another technician from the holiday in order to get the fix, in order to be told where and when Kivrin is. But because in his fevered ramblings, Bodrey has said that the fix is fine, Gilchrist, who is technically in charge here, is not interested. He is perfectly satisfied that everything is just fine, and he thinks that Dunworthy is trying to sabotage his project. But Dunworthy is genuinely worried that something has gone horribly wrong with the drop, that Kivrin just isn't when she's supposed to be. And on top of this, Bodrey's illness is a new type of flu. In fact, it's a seriously dangerous type of flu. And the protocol for this requires that Oxford be quarantined, and not just the university, but the whole community. And Oxford is a very big place in England. And this protocol, I think, strikes us as extreme, us as readers, but this is part of the world of 2054 that Willis has invented here. About 25 years ago, the world suffered a major pandemic, and they simply call it the pandemic. And during the pandemic, tens of millions of people died. And so there are now very serious protocols in place to prevent another such disaster from happening. And this quarantine means that they can't get a technician in to interpret the information that they have about Kirvin's location. And I guess this is so technical that, you know, even someone with a PhD and who could read multiple languages like Dunworthy, like Gilchrist, can't make sense of the readout display. So now this flu is just spreading all around Oxford, and the doctor character, who's a friend of Dunworthy's and is the same person who had given Kivrin her inoculations, we've actually met her several times already, and she's a big part of the emotional arc of the story. This doctor is struggling to treat the flu. She's struggling to identify what type of flu it is and to figure out how Bodrey got it in the first place and where it came from. And at the same time that this is going on, Kivrin arrives in 1320. And when she arrives, something is wrong with her as well. She's very confused. She's in a lot of pain, and she can't figure out where she is. And Kivrin gets downright delusional. She thinks even that someone is trying to hurt her. She becomes aware that she's draped over a horse and that she's being taken somewhere. And later on, she eventually knows that she's in a house somewhere. And she does understand at this point that she's very ill. But the thing is that this shouldn't be the case. She shouldn't be able to be sick at all because she's had all of the inoculations for anything that she could pick up here in the 14th century. On top of all of this, the people of the time don't understand her attempts at communication, and she in turn cannot understand them either, even though she has a technological implant that should be helping her, right? She's got a universal translator, and it's not working, and it very much seems like Kivrin is going to die here of some mysterious disease. And all of this is the parallel structure of the book, right? We've got two people who have mysterious illnesses, and we're trying to understand what the illness is, where it came from, and how they possibly got it. And of course, we're also wondering if it's the same illness, right? If Kivrin has the flu from 2054, then the net should never have let her time travel. But she's been inoculated against everything present in 1320, even against the plague that's not going to be present for another 28 years. So she couldn't have gotten sick from something in the time that she's traveled to. Unless, of course, right, she's just in completely the wrong time and hasn't realized it yet. But at the same time, we have to wonder if the virus didn't actually come through the net from the past in order to infect Badri in 2054. And Dunworthy and really all of the technicians, everyone keeps saying that that is not physically possible, right? The real laws of physics in this speculative universe don't allow for that to happen. But nonetheless, Gilchrist believes that this is exactly what happened. And so he locks down the entire network, even shuts down the entire network until this epidemic is contained and until there's a treatment available for it. So there are a number of mysteries here. One, where or when did the 2054 flu come from? Two, is Kivrin when she's supposed to be? And in addition to this mystery, Kivrin has an important mystery of her own. Because she was delirious when she came through in the middle of a forest at night, she doesn't know how to get to her drop site from the Oxfordshire village that she's living in now. And if she can't get there for the very specific rendezvous with the time machine, she's going to be trapped in 1320, or, you know, whenever she actually is here, forever. She will be stuck in the past, and she'll just live out her whole life and die here. She'll never get back home to her family, her friends, and her colleagues at the university. Of course, all of these mysteries are solved, right? The 2054 flu is actually a flu from 1320 or so, but it didn't come through the net, as Gilchrist is afraid. It didn't actually travel through time. What's actually happened is that this flu virus was simply lying dormant in a grave that an archaeologist recently uncovered, and both Badri and Kivrin had been helping out on that dig, and so they came in contact with it. And an awful lot is made of this grave. It's a sarcophagus in the church in an isolated village in Oxfordshire. And this grave, this sarcophagus, is actually how Kivrin is able to travel through time, even though she was ill, because the virus that she's carrying is, in fact, contemporary, and so it's not a threat to the timeline. And this sarcophagus also serves as a clue for us, the reader, that Kivrin is actually later than she's supposed to be. She's later than 1320 because we know that the marker on this grave is from after 1320. And it's there in the village where Kivrin is living now. And Badri already knew this when he went to the pub. And that really is what he meant when he collapsed. And now finally, when he recovers from the flu, though by this point, there have been a lot of deaths from this flu, I should say, and Badri is in fact extremely lucky to have recovered from it. But now that he has recovered, he is able to tell Dunworthy that Kivrin is in fact in 1348 and literally just days before the Black Death is scheduled to arrive in Oxford. And even though Kivrin is inoculated from the Black Death, right, even though she really definitely is not actually going to die from the plague here, that's not the only thing to be concerned about when someone you know, someone you care about, is stuck in 1348, is stuck in the middle of the Black Death. Even if Kivrin herself is not going to die from it, everyone around her, everyone that she's met so far in Oxford, is going to die from this disease, and she's going to have to watch that happen. And it's a gruesome disease, right? This is something that really destroys bodies in front of you, and this is not an experience that you would want anyone you care about to go through. On top of this, there's the real concern that if almost everyone in this village dies, or everyone in this village dies, except Kivrin, people are going to wonder why that happened. People are going to be suspicious about that. So she is still going to be in danger. So if anything, this really ratchets up the tension for us. And in fact, we jump back to Kivrin now for this third act, and we see her recognize the very first case of the plague and discover that the year is indeed 1348. And this is just harrowing, because Kivrin has come to really care for the villagers, and especially for the elite family that she's living with. I mean, there's these little girls in this family, and she's come to love them. She's come to be something of a surrogate mother figure for them, or maybe an older sister. And she also thinks of the village priest as a friend of hers. She can't bear to see these people die. But they do. Every single one of them dies from the plague, and it is heartbreaking. Willis writes all of this with just tremendous pathos. And back in the present, back in the Oxford of 2054, Dunworthy is actually now more worried than he was before, for all of the reasons I outlined just a minute ago. And so now there's a real urgency for Dunworthy to mount a rescue operation. But there are still a number of obstacles to this. For one, the quarantine has not been lifted, and Badri is still not in the best condition to be sending people through time. He's physically weakened from this flu. And Dunworthy himself now has the virus as well. And while he's busy recovering, and to be clear, he is not recovered. And this flu has a high incidence of relapse, and the relapses have been highly fatal. The relapses have been more fatal than the initial encounter with the disease or the initial symptoms of the flu virus here. So he's not really in any condition to actually be a time traveler. But he doesn't care. He has to go back. He has to go back and get Kivrin. And he does. And he's helped by Colin, who is a 12-year-old boy. And we're going to talk about him a bit later. And they find Kivrin, and they get back to the drop just in time to be retrieved, even though Dunworthy himself has relapsed, and he is really quite near death by the time they get back to the drop site. And that's the end. Kivrin gets home, and even with all of the deaths in both timelines here, this feels like a happy ending. You close the back cover of the book, and you feel satisfied. You feel like this has been a good outcome, and it feels like a heartwarming Christmas story. Okay, themes. This is a big book. It is far and away the longest book that we've done so far, though I do think that it is also an absolute page-turner, so it does not feel long, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. There are two topics I want to discuss in this segment before we do strengths and weaknesses, and those topics are family and history. We'll start with family, because I think that's something that Willis has on her mind here. It's something that's here in the book deliberately. Well, the topic of history is something I want to talk about because of my background as a historian. All right. Family. This is a theme that is all over this book, and I think we might start by simply cataloging some of the family relationships, or really family-esque relationships. So to start, the setting is a university, which by its very nature is full of people who are separated from their family, people who are without a family in a daily sense. Students have left their hometowns, and they've left their families in order to come to university. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're alone. In fact, the found family at a university can be a powerful and really fulfilling social unit. But the professors, too, are without their family, at least their extended family, and for the same reason. Just like students, scholars and scientists also have to move to where the universities are. And that means leaving behind their own parents and grandparents and siblings and nieces and nephews, the whole extended family unit. And while there's absolutely nothing that prohibits academics from marrying and having children, Willis's academics in this book, and even the chief doctor at the hospital, are all aging single adults. The one exception to this is Basingame, who's the head of the history faculty, who is using his Christmas holiday to go to Scotland on a fishing trip, conspicuously without his wife. And in fact, this is something of a joke throughout the story, because no one can find him. His wife doesn't actually know where he's decided to go fishing. And so the people stuck in Oxford even speculate that he may really just be off on a clandestine trip with another woman. Because otherwise, who leaves their family to go fishing alone on Christmas without even telling them where they are, right? And we never actually find out the answer to this mystery. This puzzle's never solved for us, which is unfortunate, I think. But it is lurking there in the background the entire time. And so in this situation of students and professors both alike removed from their families, Willis doubles down here. She really emphasizes the paternal feelings that Professor Dunworthy has for Kivrin. And in fact, this is what makes him the hero of the story. It's why he's the protagonist. It's why Gilchrist is the villain. Gilchrist doesn't care about Kivrin, and so he's endangered her, while Dunworthy endangers himself in order to save Kivrin. And there's something that Willis does with this that really impresses me. And I mean that both in the sense that I think it's well done, and also that it affected me emotionally. I mean, deeply affected me emotionally. And that is that she connects this with Christmas. She connects this with the idea that God sent his son to live in the world, even with all its dangers. And this story mirrors how Dunworthy feels about Kivrin, right? And even though this is Christmas, it's commemorating the birth of Christ, Dunworthy can't help but think about how the story ends, with Christ as the brutal victim of the people he's been sent to live among, and how at the end he felt forsaken by his father. And this is Dunworthy's worst fear, right? It's not that Kivrin will be blamed for the plague and murdered for it, but that she will feel forsaken, that Kivrin will feel unloved and forgotten at the end of her life, an end that's coming in a particularly horrific and brutal fashion as well. And this paternalism is reciprocated, right? Kivrin thinks of Dunworthy as a father figure as much as Dunworthy thinks of Kivrin as a kind of surrogate daughter. And even though Dunworthy actually has no role, no responsibility in this entire business, she addresses her log to him rather than to Gilchrist, who organized the whole thing, or to Professor Latimer, who's actually her doctoral supervisor. And likewise, she also fears about Dunworthy's emotional state. At the very end of the book, when she is certain that she is not going to make it back to 2054, that she's going to die in 1348 because she's broken her ribs and no one is left alive to help her, she leaves a message in her recorded log for Dunworthy in the hope that he'll be able to hear it when her bones are found at the excavation site in the present. And here's what she says. I mean, this is heartbreaking. "I don't want you to blame yourself for what happened. I know you would have come to get me if you could. But I couldn't have gone anyway, not with Agnes ill. I wanted to come, and if I hadn't, they would have been all alone, and nobody would have ever known how frightened and brave and irreplaceable they were." And so we can see here, right, in her own explanation, that Kivrin also has come to feel love for a child who's not her own. This is Agnes, the little girl of the elite family that she's staying with in this village. And even knowing that Agnes was going to die anyway, even knowing that Kivrin doesn't belong here, that these people are all already really dead in the real present, and that Kivrin has a life there in the present that she should really get back to, Kivrin says that she would not have left Agnes. And this is not just because she loves Agnes, but because Agnes loves her. Agnes clings to her. And so leaving this little girl, even to get back to the future, would have been an emotional blow to her, to Agnes. And Kivrin simply would not do that to her. And Agnes is not the only kid here in this story, here in the 14th century. She has an older sister named Rosamond as well, who Kivrin also really, truly loves and feels responsible for. Rosamond is 12, and she's engaged to a widowed lord in his 40s or 50s. And while Kivrin knows that this is normal for this period and that she should not judge this culture for its customs, she still feels totally protective of this girl, as I think any of us would in this situation. And especially because it turns out that Rosamond does not want to marry this man next spring when she'll have turned 13 finally. And when this guy comes to visit them near the end of the book, she actually tries to hide from him, and she's visibly disturbed when she has to be anywhere near him. And we learn here that Rosamond thinks that her father's going to save her from this man. Her father's been absent for the entirety of this book, but she thinks that when he hears about how this man has touched her inappropriately, her father's going to avenge her. But she doesn't seem actually to understand that, in fact, it's her father who has arranged this marriage because it will help his political ambitions and provide economic security for his family, for himself and for his family, maybe we should say. Rosamond doesn't understand that her own happiness is simply not a factor in the decision making of her father. And so this is another instance of someone failing to be a good parent, at least by our standards. And all of this carries over into the 2054 Oxford storyline as well, the 2054 Oxford timeline, maybe we should say, because Rosamond has an analog there in this other plot. And this is this boy, Colin, who is also 12 years old, just like Rosamond. Colin is the grandnephew of the principal doctor character in the book, and he was scheduled to come and stay with her at Christmas time because his mother wanted to spend time alone with her boyfriend where they live in London. And Dr. Ahrens is upset about this. She's not upset that Colin is coming to visit, that she's looking forward to, actually. She's upset that he's clearly being pawned off because he's become an inconvenience to his mother, who, of course, is someone that Dr. Ahrens knew from the moment she was born, right? This is her own niece. And she cannot believe that her niece is behaving this way towards her own child. But all of that is out of her control, out of her hands. And so she intends to make the best of Colin's visit, even though she clearly has no idea what a boy Colin's age would actually want for Christmas, which is another running gag throughout the story. But it turns out that this is not going to matter because the quarantine goes into effect just as Colin's train is en route to Oxford from London. And so he's going to just have to go back to the big city. Except that that's not actually what Colin does. It turns out that this kid is quite resourceful, and so he just manages to sneak into the quarantine zone and show up at the hospital more or less as scheduled. But Dr. Ahrens is dealing with an epidemic, and so she simply can't take care of Colin, and she asks Dunworthy to do this. Colin, of course, right? He thinks this is all a great adventure. I can imagine my 12-year-old self feeling exactly the same way. And in fact, he's thrilled to be picking up little jobs from a number of authority figures so that he can be useful during what might turn out to be the end of the world. And it's clear that he gets a great deal of satisfaction from this, right? He gets a great deal of satisfaction from feeling like he's important, like he's contributing, and he enjoys getting the approval of adults and the attention of adults, right? And at the same time that all of this is going on, though, he is dreadfully worried that his Christmas presents from his mother won't arrive on time because of the quarantine. But we, the readers, we know, and we know this because Dr. Arendt knows it, that his mother's going to forget anyway, that she usually does actually forget to get him Christmas presents on time. And so when we look at these two 12-year-olds together, Colin and Rosamond, what we get here are two kids who want more, really two kids who need more from their parents. And this is where our characters, our protagonists, step in. Rosamond can't get this love from her parents, right? But she finds some solace with Kivrin. And Colin has really just a host of adults who've essentially taken him in. And he's a real presence at the hospital. And even when Dr. Ahrens, his great aunt, even when Dr. Ahrens dies from the flu while she's caring for others, he tries to keep being useful. And in particular, he takes on the job of protecting and caring for Dunworthy when Dunworthy comes down with the flu as well. And it's Colin who actually chastises Dunworthy for giving up on Kivrin just because the bureaucratic and the technological setbacks that they've encountered make it look like he can't help her. And really, it's Colin who orchestrates all of the forged signatures and stolen medicines that they need in order to send Dunworthy back in time to get Kivrin. I mean, I did mention that he's resourceful, right? I love Colin. Sneaky probably is the better word for it than resourceful. He's a great character, probably my favorite character in the whole book. And even at the very end here, right, Colin sneaks into the time beam so that he'll be able to travel back with Dunworthy because he thinks of Dunworthy now as his responsibility, even though Dunworthy, of course, thinks of Colin as his. And at the very end of the book, when we have Dunworthy and Kivrin and Colin coming back through the gate, it's hard not to picture them as something of a family, even though none of them are biologically related to each other. All of this is truly heartwarming. It's a fantastic Christmas story about the meaning and about the importance of family and community. Frankly, I'm surprised it hasn't been made into a Christmas special on the BBC yet. I mean, even with all of the people dying of the bubonic plague, this story manages to be uplifting in really the best possible way. Well, all right, let's turn our attention to the second thing I want to talk about in this segment, and that is history. And here, really, I just want to put my teacher hat on for a few minutes. This is a time travel book, right? And this is a classic trope of science fiction. But the real twist here, right, is that the time travel in this world is the special purview of historians. Our protagonists are a history professor and a history postgrad student. But are they actually doing history? And as a trained historian myself, I have to say, I don't think so. I don't think these people are actually historians. I don't think they're doing history. On the first day of a new semester, I often begin my classes by asking students what history is. And I always ask it that way first before I rephrase it. And I usually get answers like stuff that happened in the past or people who lived a long time ago. And those answers are fine, right? That's how we use the word colloquially, more or less anyway. But then I ask them what history is as an academic discipline. What do historians do? And then the answers are always study the past. And that's about it. And so then I probe a little bit deeper and I ask if there are other disciplines that study the past. And we really just end up running through the list of academic disciplines, right? Things that are possible majors from the student perspective. And we see that many of them study the past in some way, including biology and physics, not to mention language and literature, the social sciences, and so on. And eventually, someone will say that what distinguishes history from the other disciplines is studying people, right? That we're not just studying the past, we're studying the human past. And that's true, but it's incomplete. And on top of that, right, there are still other disciplines that do exactly that, that study the human past. And so in what way, then, is history different from archaeology or art history? And this question then, right, this is the real stumbling block for my students, even for my history majors. But the key is writing. History is the study of the human past through the examination of written artifacts. Now, there's more to it than that, right? But that's going to be the key distinction that matters for our purposes here in this episode of A Speculative Fiction Book Club podcast. But that is not at all the idea that people outside of universities have, right? For most people, if you study the past, you're a historian. But that's not true at all. You're a historian if you study texts from the past. And that is not at all what Willis's characters are doing in this book. They're not studying written artifacts from the past. They're going to the past and making direct observations of the people they encounter there and then reporting back to other scholars about what they observed. And that's anthropology. These are anthropologists, not historians. And maybe to come at this another way, right? Would I want to make use of this technology if I could? Well, as someone who loves to travel, the answer is absolutely yeah. But as a historian, the answer is no. I'm not a historian because I'm interested in people from other cultures and want to know what their lives are like. I am interested in those things, but that's not why I'm a historian, because I could have picked from several other disciplines that do exactly that. What I like about doing history is that the act of doing history is reading books and trying to solve puzzles and mysteries that you find in those books. In fact, when I think about going back to the period I study, say to Rome around the year 520, the first thing I actually think about is not talking to people there. It's about getting access to written records that are now lost to us. I don't at all imagine what it would be like to see Theodoric's mustache in all of its glory, or see the aqueduct still in operation, as cool as those things would be. I'm interested in shutting myself in a library that has books I've never read before because they've been lost in the intervening centuries. And that's what makes me a historian. But okay, really, that's just a personal grumble about the way that history is popularly conceived, the way it's shown to us in our pop culture. It really doesn't get in the way of my love of this book. I mean, not even a little bit. It doesn't get in the way of my love for Indiana Jones either, for that matter, right? And I do really love this book, right? So let's talk about some of its strengths. Let's talk about some of the things that Willis does here with just tremendous skill and craft. And this is a well-crafted story. I mean, Willis is just a master of storytelling above all else, though I will say she is also a master at writing, but really in being a storyteller, right? Her pacing is flawless. She manages the mystery elements in her story just perfectly. The experience for us as readers is that we are dying to know if Kivrin has carried some terrible future disease back to the past, or if the Black Death somehow did actually slip through the net and come to present-day Oxford. And we also start to wonder if it's possible that the Black Death is going to turn out to be an accident of time travel. We also don't even know when in the past Kivrin has actually landed, and we want the answers to all of these questions, and we want them now. But Willis is not going to give them to us, right? And in fact, we'd love her for it. Instead, what she does is deepen the mystery. She leads us toward thinking that we figured it out, that we figured out what's going on before she's ready to tell us, only for her to introduce something new that totally undermines the solution that we've come to. Every chapter ends on a cliffhanger. It ends with us wanting to know what's going to happen next, and that keeps us turning the pages. And that literally is every chapter break. And then the book is divided into three sections. These are the act breaks, but these act breaks or these section breaks, these all end as game changers. And what I mean by that is that we get new information that changes what the story's even about. And here's one example of how this works in the story, right? This is how we learn definitely that Kivrin is in 1348, just at the moment that the Black Death is arriving in Oxfordshire. And Willis does all of this in a story that is dialogue-driven, right? It's a book that is largely just people talking to each other. And as someone who really loves long, dense paragraphs that describe what a mountain looks like or what a glass of whiskey tastes like, banter is not usually what I go to books for. But Willis is such a master of it that I actually love every moment of it. Her characters are real. Her characters are vivid. They have their own ways of speaking. And each character in this book is fully motivated, right? Each and every character wants something, and it's something specific, and it's often seemingly tangential to the story. But what Willis does is to craft a story out of how a myriad of character motivations intersect, how they create conflict, and then she resolves that conflict. On top of all of this, Willis uses these character motivations in order to show us a wide range of human qualities, a wide range of human ambitions and human emotions. And I guess what I would say to sum this up is that Connie Willis writes science fiction novels that are the descendants of Shakespeare's best comedies, right? And I will say there is also a lot of humor in this book if you're into that sort of thing. And again, I'm usually not. I don't like banter and I don't like funny in my books usually, but it all works for me here. And in fact, I'll say there's a great gag about Shakespeare near the end of this book that made me laugh out loud, which is a rare thing for me to do while reading. And lastly, and this really is the last thing that I'll say about the strengths, Willis's settings are also richly conceived. Both Oxfords feel like real places that you could go visit. Willis hits all of the senses, and one that she's especially good on, actually, is hearing. She's really great at imbuing her settings with a real soundscape, which is not easy to do at all. And something that happened in my life, reading this book 20 years ago in the Army and reading it now, this is something I'm very grateful for, is that I've lived in Oxford. I spent an entire term there as a visiting fellow at the Center for Late Antiquity, and even though it was just a few months, it was one of the happiest times in my entire life, actually. And in fact, that's where I was when Brandon and Liam and I decided to start Clay Temple Media. It was something we were actually doing in order to keep in touch while we all lived far away from each other. And since I am intimately familiar with Oxford, and it is a place that looms large in my imagination because it was such a happy time in my life, I will tell you that Willis's description of Oxford is perfect. It feels exactly like the place I used to live, this place that I love, and it makes me miss it even more than I already did. The one flaw here is that Willis sets the inciting incident in a pub that she calls the Lamb and Cross, and there is no such pub in Oxford. And I'm not really sure why she has done this, given the number of iconic Oxford pubs, Oxford pubs that in fact are iconic to speculative fiction writing. And so my only thought here is that this is supposed to be the Lamb and Flag, and the flag does have the St. George's cross on it, but that for some reason she didn't want to call it that, and maybe there was even some legal concern about it or something like that. And if you know something about that, if you know why she has done this, or, you know, even if you just want to talk about pubs in Oxford, I hope you'll come to the Atos Forum at claytemplemedia.com and let me know about it. And hey, while you're there, talk to me about the themes and motifs that I focused on, but especially on what I've left out. Although I did say that the book is funny, I didn't really dwell on that, and I'm sorry not to include a bit here about the bell ringers or the overbearing mother and many of the other elements that are really just quite funny here, and I would love to talk about those elements with you. And there are also some very interesting things that Willis is doing with Middle English that I would love to discuss on the forum. That's really a fascinating part of the book for me. But that is going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find me and all our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. On Twitter, I'm at GL McDorman, and the network is at Clay Temple Media. So now that we're all in the Christmas spirit, we are going to take a holiday break here at the network. So Atos will be back in January with Revelation Space by Alastair Reynolds. But in the meantime, you can check out our Connie Willis content on Patreon, especially if you're looking to get further into the Christmas spirit. And if you haven't listened to some of our other shows, the holiday break is a great time to do that. I mean, it's a great time to read Gene Wolfe's masterpiece novel, The Fifth Head of Cerberus, with me and Brandon. I mean, we did nearly 40 episodes on that book, so that should keep you occupied while we're skipping an episode here. But until then, until next year, I hope you'll remember that if more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world.